Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, and welcome to the Inclusive Class Podcast. Through interviews and discussions, it's our goal to explore the promise and practice of inclusive education. I'm Nicole Erdix, and I'm one of your hosts for the show. I'm a parent, inclusion teacher, and creator of the online resource, theinclusiveclass.com. And joining me here on the Inclusive Class this morning is my co-host, Terry Morrow. Good morning, Terry.
Good morning, Nicole, and welcome to all our listeners. I am Terry Morrow. I'm the author of 50 Ways to Support Your Child's Special Education, and I write about special needs for about.com at specialchildren.about.com. I'd like to mention to anybody out there listening to us live that we are not taking phone calls, but I do have the chat room open. If you'd like to stop in and suggest a question, I'll try to work it in if we have time. We're here at the start of a semester at my house. College just got back in this week, and so we're starting and doing the collecting of the syllabi and looking over what the semester is going to be, which is always a moment of panic for mom because it's, this is what we're going to, oh my gosh, and there's this paper and there's that paper, and the teacher says you better get in on time, and if you're late, you're going to be, you know, kicked out and all this stuff. And I, of course, take all this stuff very seriously. I think that sometimes, especially at the community college level, perhaps professors put things a little more strictly. It's the scare the kid to make them do something much less severe than what you're saying.
Yeah.
But the parent reads it and goes, oh, my gosh, we must completely redo our lives to get this stuff all in. So we're in that that early semester syllabus panic period this week. But I'm taking deep breaths. We'll get through it. And once we get into the school year, things will be better. And how are things at your house this week, Nicole?
Great. Actually, it's me that has the great news this week because I don't know if you noticed on my Facebook page this week.
I did. Very exciting.
I have confirmed both you and I to participate in the 9th annual Kids Included Together Conference in San Diego.
Yes.
And that will run from March 13th to 15th. And Terry, you won't be able to be there in person, but we're actually going to.
Yes, you will actually go to beautiful San Diego. I will be sitting in frigid New Jersey in front of my computer. But that's
on the other end. We will pipe you in via Skype or Google Hangout, something that will work properly.
Yes, yes.
And have you there. And you and I are going to facilitate a panel of expert guests on the topic of advocating for inclusion. So that will be
nice.
An exciting session, and that will be on the Thursday afternoon of the conference. So if any of our listeners are actually interested in going to the conference or learning more about what Terry and I will be doing and other speakers and presenters there, you can go to the Kids Included Together website, which is www.kitonline.org. So that was big news this week. And then the other big news, of course, is that we have our guest this week, who we had to reschedule back in the fall because of Hurricane Sandy. All the phone lines went down on the East Coast and all sorts of things were happening. People couldn't move around and travel around and connect. And we were scheduled to have our guest today back then. And he was unfortunately unable to contact us. And he has rescheduled and he's here with us today. And we welcome him, Dr. Sheldon Horowitz. Good morning, Sheldon. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you, Nicole and Terry. Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, like I said, we're glad that you were able to reschedule and come back. Try it again. Try it a second time, and this time it works. So,
believe me, I'm really glad to be here as opposed to having to deal with no electricity. And thank goodness we weren't really clobbered with the storm the way some others were, but it was a good 2 weeks before we were back in the office, and it was business as usual.
Wow, 2 weeks. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, we didn't really get a sense of it here on the West Coast, but, you know, all the stories that came out from that way, it sure took a while for people to get back on track and back to their regular lives. So thank you for putting us back on the calendar, and we're going to talk about learning disabilities this morning because that is your field of expertise, and you work with the National Center for Learning Disabilities. Before I we get into the interview, do you mind giving the audience a little bit more information about yourself and your background and the work that you're currently doing?
Sure. Well, my background, you know, I started off in the classroom. I started off as a special education teacher back when learning disabilities first made its debut appearance under the federal law, IDEA 94142, back in the late 70s. I was one of those folks who was charged with setting up a resource room. Who knew what a resource room was? Brand new, and you know, we were fresh out of graduate school, and they said, "Well, go ahead and do it." And there are kids who have learning disabilities, and make it work. So I sort of feel like I grew up with the field, spent time in the classroom, always had an interest in assessment. So I did some graduate work in the diagnostics and the testing of kids and working with families on information gathered that both identified and also mapped onto the kinds of things that schools and parents can do to help students with learning disabilities. In my doctoral work, I was very much interested in the neurobiology of learning. So while I was working, after having left the classroom, working toward my doctorate, I was working both in a outpatient psychiatry program with children who had learning and mental health challenges, and then in a children's hospital in developmental and behavioral pediatrics, working very closely with a team of medical professionals who were interested not just in learning but also in behavior, particularly attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. So my background, very clinical, first teaching, then clinical, and I came to the National Center for Learning Disabilities back in 1996, hard to believe that I've been here for almost 17 years, where I was given an opportunity to work with a terrific team of people who are focused on not just providing information to families and individuals, but thinking about the whole field of learning disabilities, and through partnerships and through work that we do ourselves, improving the lives of those people, individuals themselves, and parents and educators, by empowering parents to be informed consumers and effective advocates, enabling individuals themselves to make good decisions about what they need, working in the school transformation space, so working with principals and helping schools find better ways and smarter ways to be more effective in helping students with LD and other learning difficulties. And we're very active here at NCLD, and I've participated and continue to do so, helping in the policy arena so that federal law and soon some state law will be impactful in a way that really helps students achieve. We keep the bar high. We maintain high expectations. We help educators be the best they can be, and we help build partnerships between schools and families. So that's the big picture, and that's the sandbox within which I play.
Yes. Which, I mean, it's so very, you know, lots of resources available. I know that I've been to the website, and there's just so much information there for parents, for teachers, for people themselves with learning disabilities. So it's a wonderful resource, and we'll be able to pass out that information later on in the show. Let's just quickly backtrack a bit and talk about learning disabilities itself. And you know, I think most people understand the term, but can you give us more of a description of what it actually entails, what it means, and, you know, why is it so often confused with other disorders that people hear about?
Well, that's a really great question, and I think it's a great place to start, because different than many other kinds of disorders or disabilities, learning disabilities isn't a single thing. It's an umbrella term. It's a category, if you will, under which, you know, think of it as an umbrella, literally an umbrella that has spokes. So you could be under that learning disability umbrella and having very specific challenges in the areas of reading, and then in reading, even more specific in the area of decoding or comprehension or listening or mapping or writing or spelling. But you could be fabulous in math, or you could be, you know, outstanding in creative writing, or you could not have any difficulties in other areas and have a specific kind of an issue, or you could have learning disabilities that are more pervasive and touch upon many different areas. So
Right. The
way that we think about learning disabilities, and you know, this may be a little bit of a simplified way, but you think about everyone's brain being unique, and in that learning process, people need to receive information, they need to do something with it, they need to process it, understand
mm-hmm.
it. They need to store it in a particular way, which taps memory and retrieval. You need to respond to it, depending upon who's asking you to do something with it. And then you need to communicate it in a meaningful way. When students who are bright, who should otherwise, for unexplained reasons, have seem not to be able to do that, and
mm-hmm.
we've gone through some really good teaching, and they don't have sensory impairments, and they've not been faced with other kinds of rule out problems, medical problems
mm-hmm.
or sensory problems. It's that rule out process and what we know about their ability to perform, but in different kinds of ways, that enables us to say, well, they are students with specific learning disabilities.
Okay, so you're looking at one particular area, whether it's hearing, processing, responding, or communicating, and you're seeing an issue in one of those areas and realizing that that is where the problem lies, and then that would define a learning disability, so to speak. Is that correct?
That's correct. And
okay.
And they're unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
You have a child, so you're not, you would think that they would be able to do well given the other things that they do well.
Yeah.
Or given the opportunities that they've had to learn, but there just seems to be something that's not working for them. And that's the challenge. You have a really bright kid who may have difficulty reading, but who
mm-hmm.
should be in an advanced or an honors English class. Well, how does that make sense to someone who doesn't have a filter through which to say, you know what, it's the person who has the capacity and the capability. We just need to find another way to tap those strengths. Now, there are some students who don't belong in advanced English classes because the work is too hard.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And,
right.
We need to keep in mind that that's also a filter when we think about why children are not doing well. But children with learning disabilities are children who can succeed and often are succeeding in certain
mm-hmm.
areas, but who have, as one of our most prominent researchers in the field has said, they have islands of weakness in a sea of strengths.
Interesting.
So there are specific things that they don't do.
Yeah, exactly. And from a teacher perspective, it's it can become quite a mystery, when you first look at a child and see all of these various abilities in them and then, pockets of weaknesses, and you sort of end up becoming a bit of a detective and trying to figure out, okay, what exactly is it that isn't working, and how can I help with that, and how can I support that child? And, sometimes that happens in the classroom, and sometimes, as you mentioned earlier, it happens in a resource room. What are students now today most often experiencing? Are they being separated from their peers in school, or are they in the classroom for the most part? How do you find that teachers are addressing students with learning disabilities in the classroom?
If we were to look back 30 years, 20 years, even 10 years, historically, what we as an education community were doing, we're taking kids who had problems and pulling them out and dealing with them outside of the mainstream, outside of the inclusive setting, in other places.
Mm-hmm.
More and more, and this is in great part due, I think, to the understanding that special education, that the responsibility to have students be successful learners is not a special education mandate alone. It really
mm-hmm.
is everybody. So everybody in the school, from the football coach to the lady in the cafeteria to the administrator to the classroom teachers, they all need to own a piece of that puzzle, and they all need to own a piece of the success and the process through which children experience success. So more and more children are getting either push-in services where someone
mm-hmm.
else, like a reading specialist or a math person or a speech-language pathologist, is going into the classroom and working with that child in the context of the things that they're learning during the day.
Yeah.
Or the teacher, the classroom teacher himself or herself, is being provided opportunities to co-teach with or to work closely with, in a almost in a mentoring kind of a way, that expert, so that they can bring expertise not only to the benefit of the child who's struggling, but to all the children in the class. So
right.
The model has sort of flipped itself on its head. And one of the things that I would absolutely point out is that there is a new sort of movement abreast, and it's not really new, but we're calling it in ways that are drawing a lot of attention to it. There is something afoot in schools today called response to intervention,
Okay. Or
multi-tiered systems of support, MTSS, RTI or MTSS. And we have a terrific website if anyone is interested in understanding more about it. It's called rtinetwork.org. But what that does is it presumes that everybody in the school, everyone in the class, is receiving the highest quality instruction. So from the very beginning, it's not the child that's broken, but we're ruling out that the system might not be as good as it could be. And then we go through a series of tiers, like a tier two system where this child is still not pulled out, but the child is given certain kinds of direct help, small group instruction or tweaking of individual time. The teacher may pull that child away for certain kinds of what we would maybe think of as supplemental or remedial instruction.
Mm-hmm.
And then it progresses to the point where after two tiers or even three tiers in some situations of intervention and asking questions and trying things and collecting student data on how well the child is progressing, then we progress to what was the old special education model, and we go for the big guns. We do our testing to find out what we don't yet know that translates into how we can help that child. So in answer to your question, many, many more opportunities, and to a much greater extent today, students with learning disabilities are being included in general education settings, spending the vast majority of their time, 80, 85, maybe 90% of their time for most kids, in inclusive mainstream settings.
Wonderful.
What are some important keys for success to parents, both, you know, to advocate for their child in the school and to work with the child perhaps at home?
Well, the most important thing for a parent to do, or I should say not to do, is to wait.
Mm-hmm.
Parents look at their children and say, you know, he's struggling, or she's having difficulty, or she's complaining of stomach aches, or I'm not liking the test grades, but they wait. They don't initiate the contact with the school. They don't talk to their child about what really matters to them. They don't say, how are you feeling about being in that math class? I mean, they wait to initiate the questioning, and by waiting, it's almost giving permission for the problem to continue. So the absolute first key is not to be worried about a label, not to be scared of testing, not to worry that they may see something that the teacher doesn't, not to protect the child from what stigma might happen or the feelings of being different. Don't wait, because we know the sooner a parent and a teacher or a school system, as soon as all the forces combined, do some strategic planning around really high-quality intervention, that's what makes the difference. And the earlier you do it, the earlier the child is on a path to success and independence.
How well are schools addressing the needs of students with learning disabilities at this time, do you think? You mentioned that a little bit before with RTI. How are things going with graduation rates and schools' willingness to put those labels on?
Excellent question. School graduation rates continue to be a concern because students in the general population are graduating at higher rates than students with learning disabilities. Even in the general ed population, you know, public education data tell us that about 74-75% of students in the general population will graduate high school with a regular diploma, with a but only about 67% of students with LD graduate from high school with a regular diploma. So they're trailing their normal, quote-unquote, peers, their non-disabled peers. But high school graduation itself is a problem. So, include our kids. Include kids with LD in that conversation. What's even more troubling, though, is that because students, and there are two, it's a two-part answer, many students with learning disabilities are along the way being recommended to classes that won't earn them a general diploma.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not graduating with a regular diploma, and then when they want to apply to college or community college or some post-secondary kind of, you know, work or job training, they don't have the same diploma. So very important for parents to make sure that they understand where their child is in their trajectory toward post-secondary transition and graduation at their, and that they're on track. Those students who stay in school and who approach graduation, the dropout rate for general education students in high school is about 8%, maybe 10%.
Mm-hmm.
It's double for students with learning disabilities. So lots of kids, many more students with LD, are not completing high school for any number of reasons. So that is a concern.
Mm-hmm.
Those students who stay in school and who have support and who have parents who are involved and who have partnerships with teachers and are on track and are doing transition planning, and kids who are involved themselves as self-advocates as they get closer to that graduation point, they're succeeding. They're going off to college. They're getting jobs. They're, or, you know, whatever jobs are out there now. But they're doing okay. But the decisions that families, parents, and educators need to make along the way are just so critical.
Yeah. Yeah, that transition planning is a big piece of it. And I don't know. Fortunately, our high school was pretty good with it. But you really need to start talking about that early. I think most states recommend like 14, 15, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know where your kid's path is heading. You know, what does the team think your child's potential is, and what are they therefore planning for? And if it's different than what you think or what your child thinks, you don't want to be discovering that senior year.
I think the other thing that I would mention, and I think, you know, you've alluded to it a little bit, but the one of the really important ingredients, and we'll go back to one of those keys for success, we pretty much know how, given good resources and high expectations, to keep students with LD achieving in academic areas.
Mm-hmm.
But what we know about those same students is that academics is only one piece of the equation.
Yeah.
And what really matters is sometimes some of those soft skills.
Right.
So how can they, if someone stops them and said, well, why is it taking you so long to check out at the supermarket?
Mm-hmm.
They need to feel okay that they're a slower reader or they're an inefficient calculator, or, you know, it's the how they feel about themselves, who they've surrounded themselves with in terms of the person they would go to if they had a question, how they problem solve some of those social emotional things that come up, because sometimes they miss cue on jokes, or they don't, you know, they'll tell a joke in an appropriate setting, or and the other thing is there are things that they do so well that they forget to capitalize on. You know, they forget how good they are at sports or how great they are at you know, talking about movies, or what a great they make video games in their spare time, or they're great musicians. And, you know, we have to remember that there's this whole other thing besides math and reading and social studies and science.
Right.
There's the rest of the person that really needs to be cultivated. And that's so much part of that inclusive message. You know, look at me. Learning disabilities is not who I am.
Mm-hmm.
It's what I have.
Yeah.
But there's so much more of me that we should be celebrating.
Right,
and that's
a really good point. Yeah, and it's, I think sometimes you get so focused in on the deficit, and you know, as a parent, sometimes you've got the kid going to tutors after school, and their entire life is focused on the things that are hard for them, and they don't really get enough celebration of the things that they do well. And it's hard sometimes to step back and realize that you need to devote some time to those things, and that in the long run, those are probably the things that are going to you know, be the major factors in your kid's life. If you have a kid who struggles with reading, they're probably never going to get a job that involves reading. They're going to get a job that focuses on all these other strengths that they have. So
making them
feel good about those and strengthening those is an important
piece
of the puzzle.
Or if they're passionate about reading and they love literature, let them find the accommodations that work for them. I mean, we've just recently celebrated an event with an author who's a Pulitzer Prize winner. Who is dyslexic? I mean, how does that happen?
Yeah.
How do you write fiction and poetry if you know you're struggling with reading and spelling and
right.
comprehension. Well, yeah. it's how they're wired. It's what their passion is. So we shouldn't be discouraging them from pursuing that passion.
Mm-hmm.
We should be giving them the tools to do it, and
right.
we should make sure that they have everything else they need to be successful, well-integrated, adult contributing members of society.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Excellent point.
Yeah, definitely. What are some, I think you've talked about this a little bit, but what are some of the key success attributes that will help students succeed in school and in life? What do you like to see the students taking on for themselves and to be advocates for themselves?
Well, we have some really good longitudinal data that was done with students with learning disabilities, looking at them when they were in school and then looking at them 20 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And the most powerful success attribute, the one thing that sort of rose to the top, was the child's ability to articulate what his or her learning disability was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they owned it. It was theirs.
Yeah.
They could say what it was. They could explain it. They weren't embarrassed by it. It's just, it's like, I have blue eyes. That's who I am. You know, you might or might not notice, but it's my reality.
Yeah.
And that takes practice. So having a child participate in his or her IEP meetings
mm-hmm.
or not being afraid at Thanksgiving when people are passing something around to read, you know, I'm thankful
mm-hmm.
for this, I'm thankful for that,
yeah.
understand that it's going to be difficult for them, and don't worry about it. Like, just
right.
have them feel good about their who they are and you know the stuff that they embody. So
mm-hmm.
that's the most important thing, even more important than their IQ score, more important
mm-hmm.
than where they went to school. That was number one. Number two was, do they have a network of support? Do they have somebody ready in the sidelines to go to when they have a question about where to get help or how to problem solve? Or, you know, if you wait for a problem to happen and then
mm-hmm.
you start looking for help, then you're dealing both with the discovery process of who can help you and the problem itself.
Right.
Lots and lots of kids graduate from high school. They've gotten great services in high school. Schools have been helping them succeed all along. They go off to college and they don't say to anybody that they have a learning disability.
Mm-hmm.
Or they go to the workplace where they're having to read memos and write emails and, you know, and they don't say that they may be spelling things wrong and they want someone to look over their stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost as though they're setting themselves up for failure. Those
mm-hmm.
kids who don't do that, who say, here are the three people I go to. This one is for help on the job. This one is for, you know, shopping and doing math and doing my bills. And this one is someone who socially, when everything crashes and burns around me, loves me despite my learning disability.
Uh-huh.
If you have those people in place, those kids do fine.
Yeah.
So there are those kinds of things that we've learned from research. Those are the success attributes that really make a difference.
Yeah.
And you can start working on them when kids are in fifth grade. You don't have to wait
mm-hmm.
until they're in 11th grade and have one foot out the door.
Yeah. I think our guest last week brought that up when she was talking about college and how children are so well supported in high school, but once they leave high school, they leave that network behind and go into college without that network and support. And then that's where the issue becomes, can they stay in college? Can they, survive all the things that need to happen, and it's difficult.
Oh,
so,
there's our school bell, which means that it's time to wrap up, unfortunately. But I think we've shared some really, really good information about this and some good ideas for parents and educators
Wonderful.
Both to help
mm-hmm.
these children with learning disabilities. So thank you so much for being our
thank
guest
you.
Today. And I would like to thank our listeners for tuning into our program this morning. Please join us next week when we will have as our guest Lindsay Beal. Lindsay is the author of Raising a Sensory Smart Child, and she'll talk to us about sensory-friendly classrooms. Be sure to follow the Inclusive Class podcast on Blog Talk Radio so you don't miss out on the show. You can also follow us on Twitter, where Nicole tweets under the name inclusive_class, and I am at Mamatude, that's M-A-M-A-T-U-D-E. And finally, you can download our past podcasts for free on Stitcher and iTunes. Goodbye, everyone, and have a great week.
Goodbye, thank you.